This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit Progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Nate here. So I am working on a book and taking the summer off from new episodes. And I was excited to see in the news the other day that the statue of Mary McLeod Methuen was finally going up in the Capitol building. And it felt like a perfect time to listen back to this story I originally did about that same statue back in 2018. Hope you enjoy it. This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DiMeo. They had to figure out what to do with the place. It had been nearly 10 years since Congress had moved out. They'd used the room, two stories tall, stately sandstone columns, as the main chamber for the House of Representatives since right after the War of 1812. The British had burned down the old one. But Congress was growing out of it. The number of states had nearly doubled since they'd started meeting in that room, and this was a country of big dreams. How were all those future representatives of those as yet undrawn districts in those as yet unadmitted states going to fit? So they built an addition to the Capitol and moved into a new chamber in 1857, where Congresswomen and men deliberate still. But the old chamber, the old hall of the House as they called it, was sitting there collecting cobwebs. And stuff, just boxes, extra chairs, dust-covered draperies rolled up and set aside like a piece of exercise equipment bought off an infomercial and then abandoned in the old bedroom of a kid off at college. And no one wanted that. This was a historic space, where the Marquis de Lafayette addressed Congress during his victory lap of America. Where that body had debated and voted on laws that had charted the course of a nation in its first half century. Where former President John Quincy Adams had a massive stroke and collapsed face first onto his desk and never recovered. But then a senator from Vermont had an idea that people thought was worthy of the room. And this guy was kind of on a roll back then. It was 1864, still in the thick of the Civil War, and Senator Justin Smith Morrill had been taking advantage of the fact that you could get a lot done without intransigent Southern state lawmakers around, and was just passing bills left and right. And one of them turned the former congressional chamber, turned ornate neoclassical junk room, into an art gallery, into National Statuary Hall. And since then, each state has been allowed to display two statues there. Two sculptures of heroic but reasonable size, depicting two of her native sons or daughters, though Senator Morrill really didn't have daughters in mind, in order to embody their home state's contribution to the country, such that, here's a quote from the senator, "Pilgrims from all parts of the Union, as well as foreign lands, may come and behold a gallery filled with such American manhood, as succeeding generations will delight to honor, and see also the actual form and mold of those who have ineraseably fixed their names on the pages of history." And so who do you pick? Who in your history? Who of all the people who made their homes in the lands enclosed within the borders of your state? Which of all the lives lived in that territory with their various joys and trials and labors, dreams fulfilled and not? Which two of the countless dead will you raise up to represent the best of you? It's an odd exercise. They say that every New Year's Eve at midnight, the statues come alive. And I don't believe for a second that anyone believes that for a second, but they say it. It's part of the spiel tour guides give to visitors. And let them, I guess. If they like the idea of the statues wandering around, marble feet heavy on marble tiles. It's a weird guest list. I mean, some of the honorees are exactly who you'd expect. George Washington is there on Virginia's behalf. Utah sent Brigham Young, Rhode Island sent Roger Williams. But there, too, is the last territorial governor of Idaho, stepping down from his pedestal to mingle. There is humorist Will Rogers of Oklahoma, I guess trying out a bit on some less sung signer of the Declaration of Independence. There are explorers and missionaries. There are senators and secretaries of this or that whose names wouldn't mean a thing to you, whose place in this hall is just about the only thing keeping those names inerasable. There is King Kamehameha, the unifier of Hawaii. There are inventors of the steamboat and the television, the first person to remove an ovarian cyst. Gerald Ford, the author of Ben-Hur, the president of the National Women's Temperance Movement, a not particularly famous astronaut, a painter of the American West. A seemingly arbitrary assembly. But these things are never arbitrary. each of the statues in Statuary Hall, each of the people whose lives and contributions were not only deemed worthy of elevating in this way, but the most worthy, were chosen at a particular time by particular people. And so at the turn of the last century, when Kansas legislators were debating who to send, and a friend of theirs, a former legislator and a one-term governor, a longtime public servant, by all accounts a lovely man, died. They were pretty broken up about it. Next thing you know, there was a memorial in National Statuary Hall to George Washington Glick, whose last public office was pension manager for the city of Topeka, alongside regular George Washington. Each statue has a story about a moment in time and a constituency, a group of the living who wanted to say something to the world about their state and themselves by plucking this person from the ranks of the dead. And we can be charmed or annoyed or whatever you want to be by the likes of the Glicks in the hall and by the people who put them there. And we can be encouraged or inspired or, I guess, annoyed if you have some weird axe to grind by the recent influx of women, bringing the paltry total in the hall to 9. Or the 4 Native Americans who have been sent by people in state houses as a small way of saying something different about what made America. But we shouldn't pass through the hall, or let another New Year's Eve come and go, without noting that in the first 3 decades of the 20th century, as the Ku Klux Klan rose again to terrorize and murder men and women in the name of white supremacy, as more than 1,700 African Americans were lynched, as Jim Crow tightened his grip on the institutions of the South, those institutions sent their heroes to Washington. There was an article in the Washington Post, fall of 1929, headlined, "Capital Seized by Rebel Forces," that points out that after they'd failed to take over Washington 65 years before, Statuary Hall was being taken over by Confederates. South Carolina sent a statue of John C. Calhoun, the intellectual architect of secession, and sent a Confederate lieutenant general, one of the state's biggest slaveholders who became governor and senator, thanks to the work of a paramilitary group who used violent intimidation to keep black voters from the polls. Alabama sent 2 generals. North Carolina sent its wartime governor, and then a post-war governor, a man who had encouraged and directed acts of terrorism against black communities, against people newly freed, a man who had orchestrated the violent overthrow of a democratically elected city government by ginning up a racist mob of 2,000 men who drove black officials out of town and burned down black businesses and homes and killed between 60 and 300 black people. He has a statue. Florida wanted in on all of this so bad, it sent a Confederate general who left the state at age 12 to go to boarding school and never came back. Yet he was sent north as one of the 2 of the greatest Floridians. Mississippi sent Confederate President Jeff Davis. Georgia sent a Confederate colonel and sent Davis's vice president, a man whom the United States Senate wouldn't seat when he was elected after the Civil War, but who has stood in its capital since a day in 1929, when 2,000 people crowded Statuary Hall to sing his praises and sing songs of the Confederacy and of the glory days when a man could own another man, could sell off that man's children or wife for profit. And the old rebel yell rose up and echoed among the sandstone columns and the marble men. These things are never arbitrary. They are the results of choices made by people once. And so let's note a choice made a short time ago by the people elected to make laws for the people of Florida, who 2 years before had decided to remove their Confederate general from Statuary Hall. 9 African-American men and women had recently been shot and killed by a white supremacist in a church in South Carolina, and these people in Florida saw it as a small way to say something different about America. And now they have commissioned a sculpture of Mary McLeod Bethune, which will one day stand in Statuary Hall, an African-American woman who was born in South Carolina 10 years after the Civil War, on a farm that was still owned by the man who once owned her parents, where they still worked the land. And where she did too, she would later say that by the time she was 9 years old, she could pick 250 pounds of cotton in a single day. But when she was a teenager, a missionary opened up a school for black children in a town 12 miles away, so she walked 24 miles every day and became the only of her parents' 17 children to get an education. She got a scholarship to a seminary in Chicago where she studied to be a missionary
wanting to one day teach kids in Africa. But she decided instead to help kids here. She founded the Literary and Industrial Training School for Negro Girls in Daytona, Florida. It was right next to the city dump. She and the parents and folks from her church would make pies and ice cream and sell them to the men who shoveled trash next door to raise money to buy books and inkwells. She ran the school for 20 years, and it is still going, and is known today as Bethune-Cookman College. She headed the National Association for Colored Women and was an advisor to Franklin Roosevelt, was the head of his National Youth Administration's Division of Negro Affairs. Eleanor Roosevelt called her her closest friend. She was the one black woman to attend the founding of the United Nations. She died in 1955 of a heart attack. Her 80 years stretched from the darkest days of Reconstruction to Brown versus the Board of Education. Her life was too full to fit on a plaque, yet soon she will stand in Statuary Hall. May her presence infuriate the marble Confederates.
This episode of the Memory Palace was written and produced by me, Nate DeMeo. In spring of 2018, I get research assistance from Eliza McGraw. The show is a proud, proud member of Radiotopia, a network of independently owned and operated, listener-supported podcasts from PRX, a not-for-profit public media company. If you want to follow me on Twitter or Facebook, you can do so at The Memory Palace. If you want to drop me a line at any time, but particularly as I am here toiling away in the mines, working on this book, this Memory Palace book for Random House, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me at nate@thememorypalace.org.
Radiotopia. From PRX.